You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
If it feels like there are more blockbusters in theaters right now than ever before, well, that's because they really are. From Hunger Games to The Hobbit to Anchorman 2 and Frozen. But it's something you should probably get used to, and that's despite the fact that many of this year's big budget films featuring top stars like Johnny Depp and Will Smith were major flops. Harvard Business School professor Anita Elbersee explains why in her new book from Henry Holt called Blockbusters. I'm very pleased to welcome her to our show. Hello.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
What are the principles behind blockbusters?
Well, the idea is that most leading content producers, film studios, but also record labels and book publishers and television networks, that they operate by what I call a blockbuster strategy. So they make a disproportionate investment in what they see as the most likely winners. That's where the majority of their spending goes to, and the idea obviously is that those big bets bring in the lion's share of the revenues and the profits, and that in a typical year is actually what you see.
Haven't blockbusters been a part of Hollywood history going all the way back to D.W. Griffith and Cecil B. DeMille? So this isn't a new idea, is it?
Absolutely. There have been blockbuster bets throughout history, but I think what is relatively new, or something of the last decade, is that Hollywood studios are really building a strategy around it. And I think that started with Alan Horn, who was in charge of Warner Brothers, started in 1999 and said, I want to deliberately make 3 to 5 big bets every year, and everything else will be organized around those big bets.
And you compare his approach to Jeff Zucker's at NBC, and they had very different results. So did they prove the point?
Well, I mean, I'm starting that with that contrast in the book because I think it makes clear this very important distinction that most people, when they look at these industries from the outside, they think that in a world in which so much is unknown and demand is so uncertain, it might actually be better to make smaller bets or to spread your resources more equally among the bets that you're making. That seems the safer approach, and that is actually the approach that Jeff Zucker had when he was in charge of NBC television. But if you analyze the numbers, which is what I do, and if you look closely at how these industries operate, which is what I did by interviewing hundreds of people that work in these industries, you see that that is actually a recipe for failure. And what you instead need to be doing is going all in on those few big bets that you're making.
And NBC is still paying for Zucker's missteps, although he's been gone for a while.
Yes, absolutely. It's very, very difficult to climb back once you have lost that ability to make those hits.
Does Horn's background play a role in his thinking?
Well, he was educated here at the Harvard Business School, so maybe we should take a little bit of the credit for that. But I mean, he's just an incredibly smart executive. I think that is the primary reason.
Well, given how many big budget flops there have been this past year, Lone Ranger, that tanked to the tune of $160 million. Wouldn't that mean that studios would be a bit more wary about making them?
Well, I hope it wouldn't, because it is very tempting to say, oh, that went wrong. We shouldn't be making these big bets anymore. And that, in fact, was, if I think the key reason why Jeff Zucker was trying to scale it back. It seems very, very risky to make these big bets, but it is the it gives you the highest chances of success. So I hope they look at it and say, well, yes, we've seen some big flops, and it's hard to deny that there have been some big flops in the past year, but we would be in an even worse position if we would have been focusing on much smaller movies. If we would have been focusing, for instance, on the $30 or the $40 million movies.
Well, aren't if you made up a list of the greatest films of all time from Hollywood, wouldn't most of them be smaller movies? How many blockbusters would be in the top 25? Gone with the Wind? What else?
Well, I mean, it depends what time frame you're taking. I think if you're looking at the last few decades, we see many, many big franchises among the biggest winners in that space.
Well, you're talking about economically. You're not necessarily talking artistically. Citizen Kane was not a blockbuster.
Right. So those are two different concepts, right? It depends on your metric of success. I think the idea that I'm trying to explore in the book is what gives you the highest chance of success in the marketplace, and therefore gives you the highest chance of of building a sustainable business over time. You can't survive on an occasional hit. You need to make sure that you have hits all the time, and that's what Hollywood studios are trying to do, but also many of these other content producers are trying to do.
Isn't there a limit to how many mega-budget films that can be out at any given time? Won't there eventually be some kind of overkill?
Sure, there is a limit. There's only so much time that we as moviegoers have to go to movies, or there's only so much time we can spend actually watching television. There is only 24 hours in the day, of course. I'm not sure if we've reached that limit of how many blockbusters we can have in a given year. This year was, I think, a remarkable year, because many people before the summer said, well, this could be the year that it all goes wrong. But if you analyze the results, it was actually the most successful year for Hollywood domestically. So I think that's a sign that there's still quite a bit of growth.
So a studio can write off the $160 million loss on a movie like Lone Ranger because it makes it up on another blockbuster?
That's the idea, yes, that every hit pays for 8 or 9 or 10 of those big failures. Yes, absolutely.
Well,
the idea is that if you work in Hollywood, you know that you're going to run into the occasional miss. There's absolutely nothing, I think, that you can do to be 100% sure that you're going to have a hit all the time. But it's exactly that uncertainty, that idea of nobody knows anything, which is a famous saying in Hollywood, that is what makes making these big bets so important.
Well, I have been in a number of... by the way, that phrase is from William Goldman, wasn't it?
Right.
The screenwriter of Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid. He said, nobody in the business knows what they're doing. If they did, every movie would be a success. And that has often occurred to me while I'm sitting in, through a really awful film. My thought was, didn't anybody notice that this thing is a total disaster? Why did they put so much money into it?
Well, I mean, they obviously go in thinking that it's going to be great. No one tries to make a movie that is deliberately going to be failing at the box office. But you have to realize that movie making is incredibly difficult. These are projects that thousands of people work on over an extended period of time. And they often start the process 4, 5, 6 years before we actually see these movies in theater. So they're trying to guess what we're going to be into 4 or 5 years from now. They're going to try to bet on those actors that we think we're going to be liking by then. And they're going to try to make a decision based on a script and guess how that's going to translate to something that we see on the screen. That's an incredibly difficult challenge. At some point in the process, there might be signals that, hey, this is not going well. But then it's too late to stop. They've already invested quite a bit of money. So the most sensible thing then is actually to keep investing and making sure that you make it as good as it possibly can be.
My guest is Anita Ellaby, who is the Lincoln Filene Professor of Business Administration at the Harvard Business School. Her book, Blockbusters, Hitmaking, Risk-Taking, and the Big Business of Entertainment, published by Henry Holt. Well, you mentioned signing stars. Often they sign the stars who were a good box office in the past, and then they no longer are. So a lot of this is about trusting in past performance, isn't it? Is that why we see so many sequels as well?
Yes, I think what everyone is trying to do is replicate success. And the best signal we have for what's going to be successful in the future is what was successful in the past. But obviously it's not a guarantee, and that's why it will often go wrong. It takes guts, though, as a Hollywood studio executive to say, well, we're going to be making a $200 million movie, but let's bet on unknown talent throughout because it's going to be a lot cheaper to do, right? So there's an inclination whenever you're making these big projects to say, well, Johnny Depp worked out really well on all these past projects. Let's invest in him going forward. That's the most sensible thing to do, but obviously it drives up the cost and therefore it increases the risk.
And you quote Disney's chairman as saying, there is no hope if you just make a bad movie. But then how can anyone judge whether or not something will be a hit? Just because you pump a lot of money into a project and have big-name stars, might have even cultivated them, doesn't mean it will succeed.
Exactly. There is, as I said, there is no guarantee for success. And ultimately, it's up to the moviegoer to say this is a movie that we want to see or not. And again, that is not just something that we see in the film industry, as I describe in the book. That is a phenomenon we see across all the different entertainment industries.
As we can discuss a bit with Harry Potter. First, Harry Potter was a hard time getting it published, wasn't it? And then Warner acquired the rights. There was a certain amount of luck involved in all of that.
Yes, absolutely. I spoke with many of the people who were involved, and they're quoted in the book. And the way in which Warner Brothers landed this manuscript and eventually made the Harry Potter series was, there was lots of luck involved. And at some point, actually, Warner Brothers sought to partner with another studio. That other studio declined. So only when they realized how successful the book was, did that other studio come back to Alan Horn and say, actually, we'd like to be in on this. But by that time, obviously, Alan Horn realized, well, this is too big a property to share the upside with someone else. So this often happens. It's at the time that they are making these decisions, it's incredibly difficult for any of these executives to realize exactly how valuable something is.
And you quote Jamie Robb of Grand Central Publishing as saying, it is guesswork, which was the case in a book, one of their successes, Dewey, about an abandoned cat.
Yes, absolutely. It's one of my favorite parts of the book, actually. This is a publisher that made a significant bet on a book about a cat. And part of, I think, why it was so expensive, this was a $1.25 million acquisition. Part of the reason why it was so expensive is that everyone expected it to be the best follow-up to Marley and Me, which was a very successful book about a dog. And the idea was, hey, this book about the dog worked really well, and this has a similar feel to it. And then all publishers jump on it and say, we think that this might be the best possible investment for us to make. So you can believe in this very strongly, and they did, and they were right in the end because it was one of the most successful books for them in 2009. But it doesn't make it any cheaper to make these kinds of investments. It was actually a really big risk for them.
Now, what do you make of the fact that Steven Spielberg and George Lucas, we could even say major figures in the blockbuster area, pretty much warned recently that tentpole and franchise films will be the death of Hollywood? And then they pointed out that both of them had trouble finding financing for Lincoln and Red Tails.
Yes, no, I think obviously they're pointing to something that is very important, an important trend in the film industry, which is that there's less room for these middle-sized projects that are not necessarily projects that travel well overseas. There is a danger there. I'm actually not as pessimistic as some of their quotes are sounding. What I found really interesting is that Steven Soderbergh, even before they made their comments, Steven Soderbergh wrote a very thoughtful piece about that very fact, in which he also indicates that it's hard to make the projects that he really wants to make, but also indicates that he understands why, because it's about the economics, and this is not a business in which you can not focus on the bottom line. Right? There's an enormous amount at stake. There are many, many thousands of jobs that are on the line, so these studios will have to make sure that they make bets that will pay for themselves.
How well did Lincoln and Red Tails do at the box office?
I think Lincoln did reasonably well, also because it won an award. I don't think Red Tails did as well as most people would have hoped. But I don't know the exact profitability of films, which is very hard to get to.
A lot of people have been complaining recently that what we're seeing is action movies, often in 3D, with very little dialogue, none of the kind of clever dialogue we associate with the golden age of Hollywood, because so much depends on the money that's made overseas.
Yes, what we're increasingly seeing, I think, is that these Hollywood movies are supposed to be vehicles that travel well to foreign countries, because the majority of revenues are made in these foreign markets, and there's much stronger growth in those markets. If you look at China, for instance, there's still a limit on how many films can go into the market, but the limits have been going up and up and up, and at some point they may be completely gone, and then obviously that becomes a truly important market for Hollywood. I think what we're seeing also is many people who complain about those products are actually not necessarily moviegoers, right? Most movies are made for relatively young demographics, people that might be between the ages of 16 and 25, because those are the ones that actually go to the theater. So that's what they want to see. They're voting with their with the money that they spend on tickets, and Hollywood, rightly so, I think, is catering to those consumers.
Is most of the money coming from sales of tickets? Don't movies make much of their revenues outside of theaters, from DVD sales and rental, streaming, television?
Sure, there's an enormous amount of subsequent windows in which there's lots of money being made, but that is a direct that's directly correlated to how much money these movies are making in the theater. So if you have a movie that bombs in the first window, in the theatrical window, it's extremely difficult to make that a profitable movie because everyone else will walk away from it. So you have to have success in that first window in the theaters in order to have very lucrative subsequent windows.
My guess is Anita Elberse, the Lincoln Filene Professor of Business Administration at Harvard Business School. She has also written for the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Variety, Fortune. And her book is Blockbusters, Hitmaking, Risk-Taking, and the Big Business of Entertainment, published by Henry Holt. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Anita Elberse. Her book, Blockbusters, Hitmaking, Risk-Taking, and the Big Business of Entertainment. It is published by Henry Holt. What do you make of the increasing number of original programming that's being done on places like Hulu and Netflix?
Yeah, that's a very interesting phenomenon, and one I describe in detail in the book. What's interesting to me is that for a long time it looked like those players, the Netflixes and the YouTubes of this world, for instance, that they were going to be making many, many smaller bets, that they were going to be the aggregators that were going to give us access to products produced by amateurs or at least niche products. And I think what they found out over the years is that making these bets on what's called the long tail, on these products that have relatively small audiences, that is not the way to build a sustainable business.
And that's what Chris Anderson predicted in his book, The Long Tail, back in 2006, that the web was going to democratize our tastes and drive down the cost of creating, finding, and distributing content?
Exactly. And I think what those companies are finding out is that that was probably a mistake. That, yes, there's certainly the supply side of this. There's lots and lots of supply of these smaller products. But the demand really isn't there and is in fact, shifting more to blockbusters. So if you look at Netflix, for instance, they have moved away from calling themselves a long-tail company and from publicly saying that they want to have and offer as many, many products as possible to saying we're actively curating. Instead of giving you 20 documentaries about the financial crisis, we're going to select the best one for you. And even more so, I think they're making these really, really big bets on their own television series, which is frankly a model that's very comparable to what the traditional television networks have been doing for quite some time.
Although I'm not all that excited by the thought that Netflix is going to tell me which documentary I will find most interesting. But how did Louis C.K.'s experiment of offering his self-produced, self-directed comedy special live at the Beacon Theater through his own website work out?
So this was a highly successful experiment, and in the book I compare this to other experiments like that. Radiohead, for instance, in 2007 sold their own album in rainbows, self-produced it, first of all, and then self-distributed the album also on their own website. And I think we're seeing more and more examples of stars, established superstars like Louis C.K. and like Radiohead, that say, I can do this myself. I don't necessarily need all these established players. I don't need established record labels or television networks. I can go directly to the consumer. And that is, I think, one of the most fascinating developments that we're seeing in today's media world.
Well, it can work with records and with certain kinds of TV shows, but obviously when you're talking about movies, there are self-financed movies, but they are the exception, aren't they?
Absolutely. These, as we discussed, movies are a collective of often thousands of people coming together to produce these projects. it's very unlikely that at some point someone will say, okay, let's all pitch in and forego salaries for now and hope that we can self-distribute this movie and make our money that way. So yeah, it's more likely to happen in books. It's more likely to happen with comedy shows that is basically one individual making this product. And it's certainly more likely to happen in the world of music. But at the same time, and I think that's also an important trend that I describe in the book, some people that have come up through online media that have established their brand outside the traditional system, such as Justin Bieber and a self-publisher called Amanda Hawking, they at some point say, I could do this by myself, but I'm actually much better off if I sign with an established record label or if I sign with a major publisher. So those two trends I think we'll see going on in the marketplace at the same time.
What role does social media play in blockbusters, especially with someone like Lady Gaga?
Oh, yeah, they're a huge force, I think, in today's media world. Lady Gaga is an example of an artist who, I think, particularly in the first few years that she was coming up, was very skillful at using social media to her advantage to connect with fans and to build her brand. And obviously it increasingly plays a role for more traditional products and more traditional stars as well. I don't think we would have seen the kind of launch that Beyonce did recently if it weren't for social media. This was something that was announced on social media and spread almost entirely there. At the same time, though, it's not necessarily a solution for many of the smaller players. This is something that today's biggest superstars, I think, can benefit from to a disproportionate extent.
Well, we do have E.L. James' big success with 50 Shades of Grey, which started out as an e-book and print-on-demand paperback in 2011. Now it's one of the great monsters of publishing.
Absolutely, but ended up with a major publisher yet again, right? So this is not necessarily something that someone sitting in their living room can do entirely by themselves. To have a true blockbuster typically requires the kind of distribution support and the kind of marketing support that only the biggest companies in today's media world can offer.
On the other hand, despite a massive marketing budget, Lady Gaga's sales for her last album were rather lackluster. So there are blockbuster backlashes, aren't there?
I'm not sure if these are blockbuster backlashes. I think it's just proof that there are no guarantees in this world, and it starts with having a product that appeals to a large group of people, and you can have the biggest marketing campaign in the world, but if somehow the product isn't resonating with audiences, then it's not going to do as well as you hope.
My guest is Anita Elvisi, author of Blockbusters, Hitmaking, Risk-Taking, and The Big Business of Entertainment, published by Henry Holt. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Has the Metropolitan Opera's gamble on their live in HD performances paid off? Weren't people concerned that it would undercut their audiences for live performances at the Met?
Yeah, that was a big concern going in. And this is another case study that I describe in the book, and again, one of my favorite parts of the book. For me, the idea that Peter Gelb had to take these operas, these live operas, and distribute them to movie theaters around the world is truly a brilliant idea, and I think has put the Met in a much better position compared to many other opera houses around the world. It's been extremely successful. It's generating millions and millions of dollars for the opera, and they can invest that in the development of repertoire going forward. But yeah, it wasn't necessarily something that didn't meet any resistance at the outset. I think the first year was relatively difficult.
Is it important to control early audiences, especially with smaller releases?
Control them in what sense?
Well, for example, Fast and Furious series use social media in very innovative ways.
Yes, but that is not something that is relatively new and not something that is connected only to social media. It's always been important to make sure that the core audiences are with you. I remember, and it's years and years ago, that when Halle Berry was Catwoman, and that movie came out, I think they did a number of things that weren't necessarily appreciated by the core fans of the comic. That is a dangerous position to be in, because those are your strongest advocates. So you need to make sure that you speak to those core audiences first and foremost, and that they're going to be the ones that spread positive word of mouth about your product.
Now, the movies that I'm seeing pushed hardest for Oscars are not blockbusters. We got Llewyn Davis, we got Nebraska, Philomena, The Dallas Buyers Club, American Hustle. I don't know, is American Hustle a blockbuster?
Might be.
But the others are fairly modest films, films of quality. You suggested earlier that if they weren't nominated for awards, they might not have made as much money.
That's right. I think Hollywood sees the award season as a way to lift certain products and make sure that they become profitable. There's certain movies that going in, even Hollywood thinks these might have a shot at an Oscar or a Golden Globe, and that will draw audiences. And there is a little bit of a disconnect, I think, between the blockbusters that are being made and that whole award season, which I personally think is not necessarily right in some cases. It's very hard for an actor who's a comedian, for instance, to get an Oscar, even if they might have a really strong performance. But that's
unless he does a dramatic role like Will Forte.
Exactly. So that's the Academy voting, and they obviously have their preferences. But smart studio executives take into account what their preferences are and position their products in a way that gives them a shot at being talked about in this award season, and that will drive people to want to go see them.
And we see this in another way in the furor over the advertising campaign for 12 Years a Slave in Italy, where Brad Pitt was on the posters.
Right, yes. No, that's a complex situation. I can imagine that maybe some of the people in Italy thought that having Brad Pitt might be a better way to sell the movie, but obviously they shouldn't have forgotten that there was a much more important actor to the film and should have given him credit for his performance too. So that, I think, is a very unfortunate situation.
What happens when people like Jay-Z switch media and come out with a book, as he did with Decoded, or when P. Diddy winds up appearing in a Broadway show like A Raisin in the Sun?
Yeah, very often they innovate. Very often they come up with new models to sell those products, which is one of the more interesting things, I think, to look at in the entertainment world. I've looked in detail and spoken with many people that were involved in the launch of Jay-Z's book, which was a really interesting launch. So he wrote in 2010 a book called Decoded that was providing background to many of the lyrics and many of the songs that he has released over the years. And what was really interesting is that they launched this book using what was effectively a massive scavenger hunt. So they took pages from the book and hit them all across the U.S. They wrapped a car with a page. They had a page stitched on the inside of a Gucci jacket hanging in a window. They had a page at the bottom of a pool in Miami. And the idea was that people would get clues on where these pages were the idea was that they would looking at those clues and then go and find those pages and piece together the entire book, winning prizes in the process. Really interesting campaign, which won a lot of awards, developed by Droga5. But what was most interesting is that Microsoft paid for it. And that obviously was something that is not necessarily possible if you don't have someone like Jay-Z on board, because Microsoft looked at it and thought, this is a really good way for us to promote Bing, our search engine. And those types of partnerships, pioneered by people like Jay-Z, I think, are very much part of the future of entertainment.
Well, many people are concerned about the consolidation of so many studios and publishers and TV networks with film studios. They see it as a dangerous trend and complain about the cross-promotion. Sometimes a news program will do a story that is obviously promoting a movie that the studio arm is putting out. Is that something that we just should see as inevitable?
I think it is inevitable, yes. And I think there certainly are concerns to be looked at when it comes to this concentration in the market. But at the same time, it also provides them with the capital to make truly innovative choices, to really make products that are pushing the boundaries And take the risk of those products failing, right? If they would be a lot smaller, and if they wouldn't have the ability to distribute those products across the different channels that they have, they wouldn't be able to make the $250 million movies that we see, or they wouldn't be able to make a film like Gravity that's really pushing the boundaries in terms of technology. So I think it has advantages, but it also has disadvantages.
A listener wonders what effects video games have had on the movie business.
Well, it's certainly a key source of content. There have been quite successful movies that are based on video games, and I think it's a rich source of R&D. It's a source that Hollywood executives are looking to and saying, what is connecting with these younger audiences, and maybe we should be making content that is similar in nature to those video games.
Although the comic books have been the mainstay, talent does play a role in all of this, doesn't it? For example, the difference between the Beatles and the Monkees, both start out with similar kinds of promotions. The difference is the Beatles had a little more talent.
Right. The Beatles and the Monkees are a little bit before my time, I'm afraid, yeah. So I can't speak in detail.
Well, how about even before that? Studios executives have tried to be scientific about how to make movies in the past. Val Lewton, a B-movie producer at RKO during World War II, the studio would give him titles it had tested with focus groups like Cat People, and then he was supposed to make movies using those titles. He happened to be very good. Cat People is a fabulous movie. But that was an attempt to almost ensure that they would have a hit.
Right, and I think you point to something really important when it comes to the role of talent. It's a necessary condition for success, I think, but it's not necessarily a sufficient condition. So what we see is lots of examples, if you look closely at these industries, lots of examples of people that we now regard as the biggest superstars in their fields that at one point or another stumbled. And they were talented all along, it's just that they weren't necessarily given the right opportunity, or they just weren't lucky to get that one break that would bring them to the top. Lady Gaga herself was dropped from her label early on in her career, and there are lots of examples of other people in the world of music that at one point or another were dropped by their label or came very close. There's nothing to do with talent per se. It's all about making sure that there's a solid business build around these artists and that they're given the right opportunities.
Blockbusters, hit-making, risk-taking, and the big business of entertainment is written by Anita Elbacy, the Lincoln Filene Professor of Business Administration at the Harvard Business School. It is published by Henry Holt. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you for having me.